And now it's time for a weekly recap of state news. It is the Wisconsin News Roundup.
An investigation into a youth corrections facility made headlines this week after claims of abuse, intimidation, and information tampering were uncovered.
And a hostage situation in Neenah last weekend left one person dead, and the State Department of Justice is investigating whether police acted appropriately.
To help us recap these stories and more, we're joined now by Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Hi.
Well, big story this week, a surprise, a kind of shocking, this investigation into the Lincoln Hills School for Boys in Irma, Wisconsin, south of Tomahawk. What have we been hearing from that investigation so far?
So what we learned this week is that this juvenile correction facility was actually raided on Saturday after that followed basically a year-long secret investigation, a John Doe probe. The records were unsealed by a judge recently, and this was first reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, that that there were reports of abuse against inmates, a long list, everything, sexual assault, physical child abuse, intimidations of victims, and allegations that records were tampered with or sort of incidents were misclassified to avoid dealing with issues within this this corrections facility for juveniles.
And the picture that emerges, in addition to all the individual crimes, is this is a facility where safety was no longer there. It was out of control. There were risks to both inmates and the staff at this facility.
Certainly. So this is very much an ongoing story. There's a lot that we don't know, but this is up. This is only about 30 miles away from Wausau, where I am, and we've already, in the wake of this, heard from, you know, current and former employees about appalling conditions, and it's complicated. It's hard to know. The state consolidated its juvenile facilities in 2011. There used to be a site in suburban Milwaukee, and now Lincoln Hills is it. This is the state's juvenile prison, and since that time, there have been a long-standing accusations by the Public Employees Union about understaffing, dangerous staffing levels. In fact, the facility has been understaffed, as most Wisconsin correctional facilities are, and the employees are working a lot of overtime. And so what had been something that you would hear in isolated incidents, this probe suggests may have been very much more systematic or much more widespread. It's still quite preliminary, but it's very disturbing.
As you mentioned, you're not far from this facility there in Wausau. This has been big news around the state, huge news in your part of the state, I imagine.
For sure, and it's in sort of rural Lincoln County, and it is a large employer there. It was considered a sort of an economic win for Lincoln County, Wisconsin, when the state chose to consolidate to the Lincoln Hills facility when it was going to go from two juvenile facilities to one. There have been some reporting that suggests that part of what is a problem or a contributing factor is a culture clash between, you know, most of the guards at this facility are rural Wisconsinites, and many of the inmates, not all but many, may be African American kids from Milwaukee. And there was one thing that was reported was a case where an inmate from the Milwaukee area who was Muslim said he was denied to even have a Quran in his while he was there. So there's a lot of there's just been a lot of sort of back and forth about those on the guards say that they weren't allowed to discipline, or that administrators would turn the other look the other way when there were serious discipline problems or serious misbehavior or physical incidents. And on the other end, there are those saying that there were criminal acts by guards in this facility.
Are we seeing in the short term changes to improve safety, to prevent crimes from happening while these investigations go on?
So the what we know about short-term changes are that the facility's superintendent and the state's head of juvenile corrections, both of whom had had previously announced that they would retire in January, are gone. They had their retirement dates moved up to December 3rd. Today, Governor Scott Walker said that he believes that the facility is safe. I think without a doubt, there's going to be a lot of need to review the situation there, and I would expect to see changes in policy, changes in administration, and probably some long-term fallout from this.
Rob Metzer from the Wausau Daily Herald stays with us as we continue our Wisconsin News Roundup in just a few moments.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farich. We're here with Rob Metzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald, looking at some of the biggest stories from around the state this week. And Rob, another story in the headlines, kind of confusing. I think some still open questions here. A hostage situation in Neenah ultimately left one person dead. In a nutshell, can you recap what happened there?
Yeah, so around 9 a.m. on Saturday, police say a man named Brian T. Flatoff held a group of people hostage at gunpoint inside Eagle Nation Cycles in Neenah, so motorcycle shop in the Fox Valley. This standoff, I think police were alerted very, very early on that Flatoff had a gun, that the people inside the shop were in danger. The standoff lasted until after 1 p.m. So the SWAT team was called in. It's very chaotic, but what we know is that the SWAT team seemed to have advanced on the building and exchanged shots. In the course of that gunfire, some hostages say that they hit the floor. One account is that one of the bullets hit a fire extinguisher and created a sort of a hazy smoke inside the shop, and that allowed a man to sneak out, like to get out of the he left the shop. That man was Michael L. Funk, they call who a 60-year-old man they call ML. He left the Eagle Nation Cycles, but he was carrying a gun. Police say that he did not drop his weapon, and they shot him and killed him. Of course, he was one of the hostages, not the person the police say was holding the others hostage.
And that's the fact that takes us from an incident of crime to an issue of state policy. We have a fairly recent law requiring any police-involved shooting to be investigated by the State Department of Justice. So what are we seeing? What happens in this investigation now?
That's right. That investigation will be triggered. It's another related policy discussion that it has raised is the issue of body cameras for police. There is some we've been told that there is some dash cam video from the scene. We don't have body cameras from the police, but there is some evidence on that was captured by police cameras. Flatoff, the man that police say was holding them hostage, was charged with a number of felonies this week. But the district attorney said that as early as next week, he could be charged with felony murder in this case, though he did not pull the trigger on the shots that killed Funk, because he is seen as responsible for this incident taking place at all.
So we'll be watching for the results of that investigation. And then I want to move on to Donald Trump making headlines all over the country, and you at Gannett got some reaction here in Wisconsin from Muslims here in the state. What kind of things were they saying about Donald Trump's comments, especially his statement on barring Muslims from entering the United States?
Yeah, it's this outrageous statement, as is Donald Trump's want, I suppose, that I think is universally understood to be an unconstitutional, illegal proposal. But nevertheless, it's had a lot of ripple effects. It's had a lot of shockwaves, and so one of our reporters for Gannett Wisconsin Media reached out to a number of Muslim communities throughout the state. So from the mosque in Marshfield, Wisconsin, to those in Oshkosh or in the Fox Valley, really to a person, the reaction was that they wanted to use this as an opportunity to educate others about their actual practice of their religion. There was some description of sort of troubling, like an intimidating phone call that someone at the Islamic Center of Wisconsin in Appleton had received earlier this year. But it didn't sound like there was a lot of that. That is certainly a concern. But they're really the message that we heard from the Muslim community was come and learn about us, and that they wanted to see more open dialogue, I guess. For what it's worth, there are a lot of Republicans who have condemned Trump's comments. Just today, Congressman Reid Ribble from the Green Bay area said that he would not support Trump even if he were the GOP nominee.
And people have been watching for that. A lot of Republicans, as you say, have condemned Trump's comments, but people have been saying, is anybody going to cross that line among elected Republicans and say, if he's the nominee, we're not going to support him? A Reid Ribble congressman, as you said, has done that. So how about other state Republican leaders?
Yeah, he might be the first. House Speaker Paul Ryan, sort of dean of Wisconsin Republicans, condemned Trump's remarks pretty strongly, and certainly others have taken that tone as well. I don't think it's certainly not fair to say that that it's a widely shared view within the Republican Party among elected officials. But I think Ribble sort of crossed a barrier there to actually rule out supporting Trump as the nominee. That is a line that that Ryan or Senator Ron Johnson or others who have criticized Trump have not crossed before now.
Do you see any voting here in Wisconsin's a long way away? Do you see this having an impact, say, out in the Republican primary here in the state?
Well, it's Muslims themselves are a small community, and Trump has shown, if nothing else, that there is political gain to be found in stoking fears and insecurities. And I think that is a political tactic. What it's up to those who see that as immoral and have a substantive problem with that as a policy to stand against that. Really, I think that could be a long-term political winner, but it's really not about that, right? It's about the substance of the policy.
Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mensah from the Wausau Daily Herald joining us for an extended edition of our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When we think about life on Earth, it's easy to focus on the big stuff, the plants and animals that we can actually see. But an international scientific effort is looking to draw attention to the world under the microscope and the potential benefits microorganisms could bring us, from energy to food to health.
There's a lot of research going on in a variety of fields, and the recently proposed Unified Microbiome Initiative would try to bring scientists together to share ideas, research, and innovations. Our next guest is a Wisconsin researcher who joined in this call for our global initiative. Tim Donahue is in the studio with us now. He's a professor of bacteriology and director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center at UW-Madison. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll get into some of the benefits of this research in a moment, but at first, a stupid, huge question that you could probably take 3 hours to answer. What do microorganisms already do for us?
Well, so in a very simple statement, we would not be here if it wasn't for microorganisms. They create the oxygen that we breathe. We can see them if we go out to the national parks and you see red stripes in the mountains. Those are iron deposits that were made millions or billions of years ago by microbial activity. They're responsible for the health and the vitality of the plants that we depend on for food. You are not a germ-free individual, although we tend to think about microbes as only causing disease. If we tried to remove all the microbes from humans, the human population on this earth would not last very long.
So given all of that, is this a frontier here of science? How much do we know that we don't know about the microbial world?
So what we know is from years ago when I was a student, so 50 years ago when I was a student in college, we would learn, and we still teach students about organisms that we can culture, we can isolate and grow in the lab. We can now do genomics and figure out the blueprints of the organism that are there in different communities, whether it's the ocean or the soil or an animal or human, by sequencing them without ever having to isolate them. But that's basically taking a census of who's there. It's like going to Central Park. I'm from New York City, so that's my favorite analogy, and seeing who's walking around in the park, but you don't really know what they're doing for the park environment of New York City by just seeing who's there. And so this initiative is really an international call by the community, in partnership to some extent with federal funding agencies, to figure out what all those people walking in Central Park are doing, who the good ones are, and then who the bad ones are, and then what can you do to try and figure out how to promote certain activities that, again, benefit plants or benefit climate or benefit human development as we move forward.
And I understand this unified microbiome initiative. The idea here is that, this team's researching this over here, this team's over here. They're kind of in silos. They're not knowing what everybody else is doing. And then there's people who are studying problems. They're not studying the microbiome at all. They're studying energy or hunger or things like that, trying to get all these people together to figure out how they can help each other.
And so I'm trained as a traditional microbiologist. My PhD is in microbiology, and I'm in a bacteriology department here. What we really need is several things. The first is we need to bring more people into the tent of this field. We need chemists. We need analytical techniques. We need imaging. We need computational people to help us analyze these complex problems of what all the microbes are doing, if you will, again, if you go back, as they're walking through Central Park. And that requires different skill sets, and it requires, in some cases, coordinated and team activities. And so we want to figure out how to enable that activity with the idea that certain things are going to be critical, whether you're studying how the GI tract of a human impacts brain development or disease, or how the soil microbes impact crop yields, or how ocean or lake microbes impact CO2 fixation and therefore climate change.
Talking to Tim Donahue from UW-Madison. He's a bacteriology professor, director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and he's part of this proposal to have a unified microbiome initiative to help us better harness the microscopic world to help us solve a lot of our problems. Let's get into some of those problems now, Tim. Your main area of research, energy. What are some of the ideas that could help us solve our energy problems via microbes?
So, again, from this census taking, we know a lot about the genetic potential that lives in all of the sequenced genomes of these microbes. And that provides an enormous opportunity for us to look at blueprints of these organisms and see how we could piece them together, either in isolation or in what I'll call communities or microbiome. Most of what you see out there in the microbiome, if you pick up even the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, monthly, weekly, you're starting to see microbiome articles, but they're really talking about humans. In my field, microbiome or the Unified Microbiome Initiative is really talking about microbes working together in communities to do things. To give you some examples, we do that currently as a society. We use microbes to make wine, and sometimes when we make wine, it's only yeast, but sometimes it's a combination of yeast and bacteria working in community to give us a certain flavor. We're in Wisconsin. We do this in cheese, right?
And beer.
Beer is mostly a yeast fermentation, if I talk to my friends at Miller Coors, but there are certain types of beer that it's nice to have a friendly a bacterium in there, mm-hmm, with the yeast to give you a certain hoppy or other type of flavor. There are vitamins that industry makes that are made by consortia, groups of two or three organisms that are purposely mixed together, and one helps the other, just like a family, take the food and create a product. So in the energy space, we want to make fuels and we want to make chemicals in a green way to replace things that are currently derived from fossil fuels. And we can already do a lot of things with isolated organisms or with creating or engineering pathways in organisms. I think if we look back 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, we're going to see that these things that we're working on in isolation, we're going to put together to make chemicals and fuels, just like we make cheese and beer and certain types of bread.
So it could be a yeast here, a bacteria there that helps convert, I don't know, manure into a usable fuel.
Sure, or the non-edible parts of plants, like a corn stalk, into fuels and chemicals to create jobs in Wisconsin and Iowa and the greater Midwest. Absolutely. That's where we're going. I can't give you the specifics. Right now, it's kind of like a gleam in my eye, or a dream of where we need to go. We're building the foundational technology, and with an initiative like this, we hope that it will catalyze or allow us to get there faster.
And some of your colleagues who have signed on to this idea of this microbiome initiative, they're dreaming not about energy, but about feeding the world.
They're dreaming about feeding the world. Wisconsin is a leader in something that we've been doing for over a century now, and that is a lot of times when farmers plant corn or other crops, they add so-called mystery inoculants to them to help them fix nitrogen from the atmosphere in the soil. And those are bacterial species that were isolated over 100 years ago, and we still add them to the soil.
Wait, I got to ask, what's the mystery part? We don't know how they do what they do?
No, we know how they do, but, okay. You know, not to insult our farmers, but they buy these products, and they really don't know what they are, but I know what they are.
Okay.
Right? Others are very interested in this in the field of marine microbiology, because in the oceans fix most of the CO2 that are actually sequestered on the planet. And that's critical for climate change and global warming. And we want to know who's doing it, and to the extent that we can, without disturbing the ocean ecosystem and coral reefs and fish populations, how could we control that to help mitigate what human activity is doing to climate change?
So I want to go back, you know, 70-some years ago, we had these glorified adding machines we were calling computers,
yep.
And now we're carrying way more powerful computers in our pockets, our watches, right. There's the internet. Are we at that stage now where we're just at the dawn of a new age of biome research?
I really think we are. And so maybe not 70 years ago, but 30 years ago, when I was a young faculty member here, we were talking about sequencing the human genome, mm-hmm. and using that to help solve disease. Well, you know, we now know there are more genes in your body that are of microbial origin than there are of human origin. And I think we're going to look back and say, we now know that everything from development when you're born to maturity as you become an adult, to aging and immune function and Alzheimer's disease is really can be driven by the activities of the microbes on your skin, in your mouth, and in your gut. And hopefully we're going to be able to figure that out and really look back at this time as being a critical time.
I'm hearing a lot of excitement. I think part of that's you, but it sounds like it's also an exciting time to do the work you're doing.
It's an exciting time. As you said, this is an international activity. You, I think, picked up a paper that was published in Science magazine. There was a companion paper by European and Asian Rim scientists, as well as U.S. scientists, published in Nature magazine the same day. Coordination like you've never seen before. And the federal government, despite the budget situation that we're in, has queried over a dozen federal agencies who would love to invest in this field if we could find the money to do it, given what's going on.
Tim, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me here, and I'd love to come back before I go under the ground to feed the microbes and tell you what exciting things we've done.
That sounds great. That's Tim Donahue. He's a professor of bacteriology and director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center at UW-Madison.